On the morning of July the 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan vanished over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. Now, 82 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart podcast.
June 1st, 1937, Amelia Earhart jolted and bounced her fuel-laden Lockheed Electra into the bright Florida sky, setting out on the first leg of her daring attempt to fly around the world. In 1928, she became the first woman to fly the Atlantic as a passenger. 4 years later, determined to achieve distinction in her own right, she became the first woman to pilot herself across solo. That made her the first aviator of either sex to equal Lindbergh's daring feat. By the time she departed on her round-the-world effort, she'd become a friend of First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt and an inspiration to millions of American women. On July 2, 1937, 22,000 miles into the journey, Earhart took off from Lae, New Guinea, heading for Howland Island, a mile-long dot in the Pacific. With Earhart overdue, the Coast Guard ship Itasca listened helplessly to her request for a fix on her position. She flew on, unable to hear their replies, running low on fuel. No trace of the plane or of its passengers has ever been found.
Within the Congressional Armed Services Committee, the intelligence community retains a non-itemized appropriation referred to as simply the black hole. For over two decades, part of the funding went to analyze if the human mind could be used to gather reliable information. What you are about to hear is the report the U.S. intelligence community would have received had they targeted the Amelia Earhart mystery in the interests of the people of the United States of America. Tonight, with just three more episodes of the podcast to go, author and investigator Scott Seeds joins us via Zoom to discuss Operation Stargate, the World Flight Mystery, and how remote viewing may hold the answer to the greatest mystery of all time. Scott, the first thing I want to ask you, it's the same question I've asked every other guest on the previous 77 episodes of the show. Can you tell me a little bit about your education, your professional background, please?
Yes, I have a BA in political science and from Western Illinois University. I have some master's work. It's incomplete. That would be my educational area. I had a career in what's called global logistics management. So I have a book out in logistics during the deregulated period from 1980 until the 9/11 crash, when logistics were re-regulated. And so that was pretty much the period that I worked in the business. And so that's my background, is how I made my living during those years.
The second question I always ask everybody is, how did Amelia Earhart come into your life? It's really a two-part question. Can you tell me first if you have any early recollections of her, the earliest memory you can think of? And secondly, can you tell me how she came into your life in a professional sense?
You know, I read history as a kid, and I read all kinds of history. I read history books. I just loved history for some reason. It was my thing as a boy growing up. And I'm not really sure when I first heard of it, but I think it was early teens when I first heard about Amelia Earhart, and the mystery was an interesting kind of thing. How could someone just disappear and no one could figure out what happened to her? It was something that really kind of took my imagination as a boy, and I never really did anything with it. I just read about it, and then I got into writing a series of books with this guy from military intelligence, and this was one of the books that I wanted to solve this mystery on.
Do you know, was there anything that when you sat down with your partner, who we'll mention by name in just a moment, did you guys talk specifically about doing this book? Can you tell me how that all came to be for you?
Well, originally what I was doing, I wrote about 80 articles in the United States and Europe on global logistics operations between six different publishers. And I wrote for like 20 years. I was a columnist writer in the trade press, and you can make money writing articles, but you really can't make a living. And so it was time for me then, after you know, later on, let's get about 2000 and beyond, that I want to start writing books. And so that's how I got started. The thing was, is I was casting around for, you know, exactly what would I like to write. I mean, anybody can write a book. It's called an autobiography. But the thing about it is can you write a book that people would really buy and want to read? Well, at this time then, in about 1996, the Operation Stargate got blown open. This was this black ops operation that we'll talk about in a minute here. And this was fascinating in that these guys had worked for 24 years for, you know, all different branches of the United States Armed Forces, military intelligence. And now these guys were out of the military. And that you could actually hire them to do work for whatever project you had going. And that's when I first started, and I contracted to start working what they call targets, and Earhart was one of them.
Now, you just mentioned Operation Stargate. I've done a little bit of research on that and kind of leading up to talking with you tonight. Can you tell our listeners, people who have never heard of it before, tell us a little bit about Operation Stargate?
Okay, Operation Stargate started when basically our project got started in 1972. The Russians got involved with it earlier, and what this was they were, okay, the United States operation was focused on, could the human mind collect data? Could it be used to collect data? The Russians were involved with, could the human mind manipulate objects? And what they were doing is, and it was kind of malicious to the extent that they were, the process is called telekinesis when you move things. And they were able to focus on, like a frog, and create heart arrhythmias, which you would call a heart attack probably, and actually could kill frogs and things, but mentally. And so then they ultimately, they turned around to see what else they could do, and they started killing prisoners. There was guys that were up for execution in the Soviet judicial system, and they used these guys to see if they could cause heart attacks. And United States intelligence found out that they could. And so all of a sudden you have this situation where you've got NATO versus Warsaw Pact back in the day. If they could create heart attacks in the German chancellor and the French premier and the British prime minister and the American president and the supreme commander, Allied Powers Europe, and if they could do this all at once with five different guys focused on these five top people, it wouldn't matter if it was an offensive or a defensive war. You'd have the upper hand because you just cut the head off of the enemy. So this became a threat assessment at the Pentagon. And so they set up, they went to the number one psych school in the United States, was Stanford. And they have a think tank called the Stanford Research Institute. And they got a PhD out of the Navy to go in there to see if they could test this to find out, was this really a threat assessment, or was this all just a bunch of funny business? You know, it sounds like it's funny business, but they knew that there had been deaths. And so they thought, well, okay, let's see what we can do with it. And they found out, yeah, the human brain with certain individuals does have the ability to collect data.
Let's talk a little bit about Joseph McGonigal, because I know he kind of ties into that, and it's a name that some of our listeners may have heard before, but a lot of them probably haven't. Can you talk a little bit about Joseph McGonigal, how you synced up with him, how you became your partner on this particular series and this book?
Yeah, McGonigal was the number one. Okay, he's called a remote viewer. And here's when people get goofed up with this. They use the word psychic because that's all the word that they know. They're not probably going to say controlled remote viewer, but it's very, very different. The military program has nothing to do with storefront psychics. And this is where people, you know, they try to lump the two things together. What the military was involved with was the area of study of the human mind is called neurophysiology. And what these PhDs were doing was trying to figure out, I mean, we know a lot more now, but back in 70, 71, 72 type time, they were still trying to figure out the proper way in which the brain can be studied. And particularly with these guys, they would, you know, put something inside of a box and they put the box in a different room and they'd say, tell me what's in the box. Well, you know, the guy just has to think about it and through his mind has to figure out what's in there. And they were able then to bring people in that could tell you or weed people out that couldn't. That's how it, and McGonigal turned out to be the number one remote viewer for the entire operation. This guy was the go-to guy when the Pentagon, the CIA, whoever it was, National Security Council, whoever it was, had to have the answer, and there was no way to get there to find out. And so they would go to Stargate with a what they call a target, and they would work the target under totally controlled conditions. Now, you have to remember, this sounds funny to a lot of people, but these guys had to go to the House Armed Services Committee to get budgeted every year. They did for 24 years. And because there was a lot of skeptical people, no matter where you go, there's skeptical people in the House representatives, people, the representatives didn't really like this because they didn't want it getting back to their constituents that they were paying for this. So what they did is they made the guys come before Congress twice a year in these closed door. It was black ops. You know, don't ask, and we won't tell you what we're doing with the money. We just want $5 billion type thing. And but Stargate, which turned through five different incarnations as they moved it around from the Army Intelligence into CIA over to Department of Defense, you know, moving it around so that the Russians couldn't figure out what you were doing with it. Ultimately, they had to go every 6 months for funding. And the only reason that they got funded was because of the quality of the data.
So we kind of know a little bit about the background now. You've kind of educated us on that. Talk about the process of the book. When you sat down with McMonagle, and talk a little bit about, you know, that whole process in general.
Yeah, I went out to a place called the Monroe Institute in Virginia, and McMonagle lives close by to the Institute. And this is a place where the Army had sent people to, okay, the whole thing has to do with hemispherical synchronization of your frontal lobes of your brain. And this is done there through audio headphone work where you, with different sound waves, they can do this. And this helps psi functioning. So these guys would go to the Monroe Institute for this. And McMonagle lives close by in there, up in those mountains. This is in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. And so I went out there and I met with him, and we sat in the cafeteria, and I told him that I wanted to write a book series, and would he be interested in, you know, how much did he charge per target and all these different things. I couldn't tell him what it was. You can never tell a remote viewer what it is you're going to do. If you tell them, like, we work Titanic. If I told them Titanic, you got to throw it out, because you have this analytic overlay is what it's called. It's called AOL. And once you tell a guy what the target is, you got to get a new target, because he has preconceived notions, let's say, about Titanic or something, about Amelia Earhart, and those preconceived notions will cloud the data stream. And so you really have to be secretive about what it is you're going to do. And I didn't really work with him face to face on targets. It was all through the mail and some fax work. And you have to send a double blind envelope to his wife, who then presents it to make sure that there's no way that Joe McMonagle can figure out what's in that envelope. If he can figure something out, it will hurt the session.
So that's one of the most fascinating aspects of your book and this process that you do. The whole time you're working with Mr. McMonagle on this, he doesn't know what case you're working. So you're feeding him information and details about the case, but you're basically, like you mentioned, it's a double blind. So he doesn't know what the conclusion is he's arriving at, and he doesn't know who the conclusion is, or the conclusion's about, I should say. So can you educate us a little bit more on that? Because I really want to drive that point home. That's what really one of the reasons that this book is so fascinating.
Okay, in the Earhart book here, The Take Off to Oblivion, you know, he gets the envelope when he looks at it, and everything in remote viewing is writing. There's none of this stuff where you go in some place and sit down in front of somebody and talk about stuff about, you know, is my boyfriend cheating on me or some such thing. I mean, there was never anything personal with regards to this. But in this case, the target, the first thing McMonagle says about it, now, okay, I had to target Lay City Airport. I didn't know what the answer was. So there was no way that I could target the Amelia Earhart mystery. The only thing we could do is target the airport and then have him follow that airplane, bring it forward in time. So his first statement that he says is that this seems to center around some kind of an island or a mountain spine jutting out of the water. So far, it looks like some kind of an accident involving water. Seems to be some confusion around communication as well. These are the first things that are on his mind that he writes down. The mountain spine did turn up. It was the mountain spine is a spine down the what's New Guinea. What was interesting about it is there was a gold mine in there, and he was assigned to look into the aircraft. There was, okay, not previously known, there were three aircraft on the ground at Lee City Airport, and being of his being a military intelligence thinking type guy, mentality on what to do, he went inside the fuselage of all three airplanes.
I want to ask you about the conclusion you both arrived at, and I'm going to ask you to set it up. So July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart, Fred Noonan, they're in the Electra. They leave Ley, New Guinea. It's 2,256 miles to Howland Island, so it's a long stretch. They're in communication with the Itasca. They never make two-way communication. That's been properly established. I think everybody listening to this show will know that already. Right. Let me ask you this. Let's pick it up from there. In your opinion, and then the conclusion that you've made in this book with McMonagall actually assisting with his talents, tell us what happens next.
Okay, well, this is the evidential detail series. So we had the answer to the mystery before I wrote the book. So I wrote this backwards. And so the thing about it is that you're trying to look into the literature to find out what there is that coordinates with what McMonagall says to see if there's any discrepancies. And so as they're getting ready to take off, there's this, the Press Tribune in Oakland gets this telex, and then, let me just read this quote. Lockheed stands ready for longest hop weighted with fuel and oil to capacity. However, clouds and wind blowing wrong way. Consider keeping her on the ground today. In addition, Fred Noonan has been unable account radio difficulties to set his chronometers. Lack knowledge of their fastness or slowness. Now, this is a critical message. So that's kind of how it starts out when these guys are getting ready to leave. Let me read another quote. See, the thing about it is I quote contemporary sources. Okay, this is McMonagall helps you understand what happened, but you know, this is not about really psychic so much as it's kind of like lead me to where I need to go to find this out and solve this mystery. Okay, accurate forecast difficult, account lack of reports your vicinity. Wind east southeast about 25 knots, which is like 28, 29 miles an hour, to ship Ontario, then reversing east to east northeast about 20 knots, which is like 23 miles an hour, to Howland. That's from Fleet Base Pearl Harbor. What we found here, and for the first time ever we came across this, and I didn't really see this anywhere else, is that winds blow out of the Antarctic and they head north, and then they run into the winds that come out of the Arctic at about 4 degrees north of the equator, and it's called the intertropical convergence zone. Now, this is generally about 4 degrees north of the equator, and Howland Island is 2 degrees north of the equator. It's not part of the daily flight plan for that day. They're going to run into the zone tomorrow. Whenever they head up to Honolulu, the convergence zone is not something that they have to worry about for today's flight plan, but it really is. So what we found here was like, okay, so they say it there. There was a 6.6 degree latitudinal difference in the zone had moved south. So their flight plan was now fatally flawed, and they're flying in the dark. They don't really realize that they're running in the Arctic winds on the day that they're headed to Howland Island. This is a critical thing, and you know, I never really saw it in anybody else's book, but this is like, this weather was like a bottom line problem for them. Everybody talks about clouds. Well, yeah, there was probably about a whole time zone wide of cloudiness. And they're in this cloud bank, and they have these reverse direction winds that they're in. So Fred and Amelia had departed without this critical reverse wind weather update. They had trimmed the plane for an east-northeasterly direction in a 28-mile-per-hour headwind on their front right, that's the starboard side of the plane. Well, okay, let's move forward to 10:30. They're about 30 minutes late. They get to the Ontario, and at 10:30, Earhart radio says, a ship in sight ahead. They're looking at the Ontario. So I'm going to read you a quote out of someone else's book here, one sentence here. It says, near the middle of the night, Lieutenant Blaisley of the Ontario, a coal-burning beacon ship from Samoa on station midway between Ley and Howland, noted that a frontal system had moved in. Okay, Pearl Harbor was correct. The convergence zone was confirmed at 6.6 degrees south of where it's normally encountered. Now, see, these are the evidential details. This is not just me putting something forward or having McMonagall say anything about it. This was just pure research. Pearl Harbor says, watch out for this. The lieutenant on a ship reports to the captain. Lieutenant on the night watch reports that it moved in. This is like almost like brand new stuff for the Amelia Earhart mystery, knowing that they're flying. The plane is trimmed against wind from the south, But the thing, let's just say, for example, you got the rudder on the plane. Let's say in order to take on a 28-mile-an-hour wind, the rudder has to be trimmed at 20 degrees. When the wind comes in from the opposite direction, you got to swing that rudder, let's just say 20 degrees in the opposite direction to take on a wind that's coming off your left now. They didn't do that. If you don't change the trim, the plane will fade faster in reverse winds. They didn't know anything about it. They didn't have the radio reception. And so they're fading faster than they normally would, even if they just had the trim straight ahead. So, you know, this is like a critical component of this whole Amelia Earhart thing. And this is the only book I ever found it in. It appears that we're the first people to match up Pearl Harbor with the lieutenant on the ship.
Now, knowing what we know and talking about what you just discussed, what was the conclusion as far as where do they end up? Because that's one of the things I think is really fascinating about the book, too. I mean, everybody wants to know the ending, but they want to put the period on the sentence. Let's do that now. Tell us where they ended up.
Well, they ended up in Nicomero, which was called Gardner Island for 150 years. But when they became the country of Kiribati, they renamed it to a word that's culturally correct for them. And so it's Nicomero today.
Now, what do you conclude happened? Or what do you hypothesize happened once they landed on Nicomero? Can you talk a little bit about kind of what happened from the landing forward?
Okay, the landing is a complete fairy tale. They never landed anywhere. There were never any castaways. I can tell you how they approached the island and everything, and which I wanted to do. I wanted to continue on. They say that they approached from the north because they were flying north and south on the line. It was totally false. They did not approach from the north. There was no intact electrical landing.
In the second edition of your book, you have a new piece called Cockpit Dynamics, and I want to ask you first why you wanted to reissue the book with that piece added, and just kind of explain to us kind of why that was in there.
Well, okay, as they continue on past the Ontario, they're flying in a strong reverse wind system, severely reduced communication with cloud cover preventing starlit navigation. And so they're in a worst-case scenario for finding a speck of land in the Pacific Ocean. The thing about it is McMonagle then sends these drawings of these reefs. Well, I'm going to read a little bit of McMonagle here so the people can understand what a military intelligence report sounds like from Operation Stargate. McMonagle says, they realized they had missed their primary destination when they were approximately 50 minutes overdue and made a decision at that point, which was pretty much an accurate one, that they were somewhere south of the primary destination. There seems to be a lot of confusion with regards to communication, and the pilot is changing course drastically, essentially turning and flying in a north-northwest direction, which they feel will ultimately bring them to a place where they can set the plane down. Now, this north-northwest, you know, they're flying northeast to get to Howland, so no one's ever spoken before about a northwesterly thing. But they were about an hour past the longitudinal line, which is the 157-337 line, but they were still in clouds until like 6:30. And so what McMonagle does is he says, okay, here's where they made the turn. And he sends me these drawings of U-shaped reefs and E-shaped reefs, capital E. And he says, these are the reef structures that they went over to get back to the line so they could head north on the longitude. You know, I went years with it. Well, okay, at the time when I got this, there was no Google Earth 3D. And finally, when this came up, I just got tired of not knowing where this was. And, you know, was there even a reef structure locally there? And the answer is, yeah, there was. And it's called the Carondelet Reef. And so we've added a new word, I guess you could say, into the mystery here. The Carondelet Reef, I went to the top of it. I went maxed out all the way as close up as I could on Google Earth. And I went down the, you know, reefs are kind of gnarly. And they're all over the place, and they're just outcroppings of stuff. And so, but sure enough, I came across these E-shaped reefs, and I came across then south of that the U-shaped reefs where they actually made the turn. And in the book, if you know, for people that are interested, there you get copies. You get a copy of the Google Earth 3D picture that shows the U-shaped reefs and also his drawings and also the E-shaped reefs and then the Google on that as well. And they're lined up together. So for people that, you know, want to see this. And then we also have the reverse trajectory that the plane took. A review of Cockpit Dynamics points to Fred attempting to avoid conflict with Amelia. See, Fred's got He's got the data. He's been able, they have enough sun where he can do this. And so, okay, with his calculations, he realized they were 4.5 degrees south of the equator. Then after looking at the fuel gauge, he realized, number one, the world flight would not be a success. Number two, they may have to ditch at sea. Number three, he wanted to delay any emotional upset in the cockpit. So here we are then with some what sounds like speculation until you get to the next radio message. Fred must have told Amir that they had passed the longitude and would now be approaching Howland Island from the east, which is from the other side. He led Amir to believe everything would be okay on this reverse heading. They had enough fuel to make it back, so this reassurance held their report for almost another hour. Well, the thing is, okay, then we move on to radio, Earhart's radio 742 in the morning, calling Itasca. Now, this is based on what Fred told her. We must be on you, but cannot see you. See, and this has thrown historians off ever since. Everybody believes that they're at Howland Island. They just can't seem to find it. But they're nowhere near Howland Island. We must be on you, but cannot see you, but gas is running low. Been unable to reach you by radio. We're flying at 1,000 feet. That's what gets through the cockpit dynamics. We now know the statement, we must be on you but cannot see you, at 742 confirms our Noonan scenario. They were actually about 400 miles south of the Itasca. So this clarifies that Fred led Amelia to believe Howland Island would be there when they got back to the longitudinal line. Okay, at 758, she says, we are listening but cannot see Howland Island. Cannot hear you. Go ahead on 7,500 kilocycles or with the long count now, or on the scheduled time on half hour, the scheduled time on half hour. What are the cockpit dynamics on this message? 16 minutes later, Amelia still cannot believe she should be seeing Howland Island. She is surprised she cannot hear the boat when she's supposedly over Itasca, and Fred does not let on. So this is what's going on in the cockpit. This has never been available to historians before. And it's a complete reinterpretation of the 742 message, which is also critical with regards to them being south of Howland Island rather than being south of Nicomararo is what I mean, rather than being around Howland Island. At 8:43, it says, the radio message came through to Itasca. We are on the line of position, 157-337. We will repeat this message on 6210 kilocycles. We are now running north and south, heading north and south, we're running online. Okay, the cockpit dynamics on this is the word now. The word now is a clue that's been hiding in plain sight ever since. It means they were on the line at this time. It confirms they had returned to the line. Okay, so this north-south thing has always been a problem for these. People think, and particularly like this is one of the cornerstones in the foundation of the Tiger Group, is that they were flying north and south. You have this navigator jargon, okay? Fred Noonan says, okay, we're on a heading north and south. It doesn't mean that they're reversing the plane up and down north and south, flying north, 100 miles, flying south. Doesn't mean that at all. It's navigator talk, except that Amelia is saying it, and she's not a navigator. So people, they say we're flying north and south on the line. People have been fooled into believing that they were actually reversing things. The problem with this is anybody, and this is what really kills me about the Tiger Group being fooled on this, is that what it means is that Fred Noonan could not figure out if he was north or south of the equator in sunlight. And that's just simply absurd. I mean, someone's going to tell you that it's time for a cup of coffee. You know, there's absolutely no way that he would know if he is or isn't north or south of the equator. It's ridiculous. But see, this needs clarification because really this is the first time in the history of this mystery that this north-south thing has been clarified and why it was said. Okay, we need to talk just a moment about Nicomararo as an atoll and about this. The atoll has a 300 to 350 foot wide coral reef around its edges. At low tide, it is broad and flat, adding many acres to the island. In 1937, the closest tidal records were kept at Hall Island, some 165 miles east. The United Kingdom's Easy Tide officers indicated that Hall Island's low tide was at 7:43 on Friday, July 2nd, 1937. Now, I'm the first one that I know of, because I never saw anybody else that did it, that went to the UK, went to London to get the tides from the British. I never heard anybody doing that, but I mean, it seems that you would do that if, you know, if you're going to land in an area where the tides are in control of it most of the day. I mean, it does empty out for, you know, 20, 30 minutes or some such narrow timeline. But anyway, okay, so we've got this, and the timeline fit just right. It just went kerchunk with regards to where they're located and when the tide is starting to rise. So once again, McMonagle's right on this. You know, it's just amazing how this guy can continue to just go ahead and tell it exactly as it is. And then you research it, and it turns out to be that. Now, if you get the book, we do have the all the pictures of these islands and exactly where the impact was. But it is a hidden coral shelf someplace between 9 and 9:15 when they arrive. Now, they're out of gas, and they see this island, and it's got a curvature. The east end has a slight curvature in it, and it's obvious. Some people aren't aware, but this was not Amelia's airplane. This is Purdue University's airplane, and she's going to try and snug this thing up into the curvature on the east end of Nicomarillo. The thing about it is that they get there at a time, and, you know, I would personally like to know exactly how high this tide is, but the tide is just high enough to conceal what is basically an underwater butte-type mountain, kind of a cliff. And she's headed east into the sun. The water is shimmering. She sets this plane down. She figures she's going to go ahead and snug this thing up onto the land. And wham, she just flies right into what is basically like a concrete abutment. It's just that it's coral, but it's just as solid. And the plane hits. The tail comes swinging all the way over onto the all the way over the top, and hits on the coral reef, and the thing then slides down into the water and is gone. According to McMonagle, this thing is gone in about 3 minutes, and it's out of gas. There's no oil slick, and it rolls down the side of what is basically a volcano. Nicomarillo is a volcano, and the lagoon is what's known as the caldera, or the throat of the volcano, is how that turns out. So they'd be rolling down the side of a volcano. So you think, okay, they're going to go down about 3,000 feet. But McMonagle, he says it's 650-foot depth. He tells you what segment of the island it is, and he gives you how many feet it is from the end, the tip of the exposed reef. You know, I showed this to some people. They said, oh, no. If you're going to be at 1,400 feet, you're going to be down 1,400 feet. You know, get out of here. You know, you're all wrong. But, you know, I had gone to the British, and I had this map from the British Admiralty. They took soundings. This was a British protectorate island for like a century, maybe probably more than that. And it actually, Nicomarillo was the last colonial outpost of declared British territory. It was their last thing that they did. And so as a result, they took soundings around it. And so, and this was in the 1880s. So I got a copy of that map. There was this area there that was not deep. Okay, this thing was dropping, like those guys had said, from like 72 feet down to 1,260 feet in a short amount of time. There was a steep descent. But in the area where McMonagle said it went from 168 feet to 198 feet in the same length of distance. So it's a very gradual slope there. So now there's something wrong with these guys. They haven't studied the map. The thing was, is that what finally did it was in 2012, the Tiger Group hired, okay, it's called the Hawaiian Research Institute, Underwater Research Lab at the University of Hawaii. And they have a ship, and they go out and they map the ocean floor, generally for people that want to do ocean mining, or for petroleum companies that think there's a petroleum deposit. They want it to go out there and do the surface of the ocean there. And their thing there at University of Hawaii is they want to try and map out the entire Pacific. So they do the Pacific. Woods Hole Oceanographic does the Atlantic and the Mediterranean, that kind of thing. And those two guys kind of have their bodies of water that they work. So they were paid to come to Nicomarillo. Well, they're doing the West End because the Tiger Group thinks that they landed on the West End. And then on the day before that the Navy flew over to look at it, that airplane was mysteriously pulled into the ocean with the same tidal action. Now, nobody knows how this is, and you just have to believe it. There is absolutely no supporting evidence of that. In fact, everything is pretty much to the contrary. There was no storm. There was no tidal action that's going to do anything more on the day before than the previous 5 days to pull that aircraft into the water. But that's the theory. The problem with these other theories is, what do you have? The missing file. Well, the file's missing. Or you've got someone that died mysteriously. Or you've got some sergeant that told the privates to stop talking about this. Or you've got somebody that overheard somebody in a restaurant. Right, and that's their evidence. It's not evidence at all. So the question is, okay, do we have any evidence? And yes, and so we're back to this critical Amelia Earhart's crash in March of 1937 at Wheeler Air Force Base in Hawaii. Now, I don't know anybody else that's talking about this as a critical component, but this crash, and it's not so much the crash, but it's the repairs to the airplane that were made, absolutely identify this as this aircraft as being at Nicomarrero. One of the things, okay, when the airplane hit, everything in the cockpit blew forward through the windshield, including the plexiglass windshield itself. What was interesting about this is that the original spec on the Lockheed airplane was having a 5/32 thickness, plexiglass thickness. And I don't know if it's because plexiglass was manufactured better or wind tunnel studies made it, but when they put the new windshield in, it was only 1/8 inch. They were able to lower that down to reduce the weight, which is always the big deal in aviation, reduction of weight. They put in 1/8 inch plexiglass windows. It was what they called an updated part. This is the only airplane that had the new windshield. So the thing about it is that the problem with the Tiger Group is, hey, here's a piece of plexiglass, it proves castaways. No, this does not prove any post-crash human behavior. You can't right. tell, look at a piece of plastic and tell me that means people lived here. No, actually, smashed plexiglass, which is a tough product, implies high impact crash. Doesn't imply castaways. But anyway, so they say, there he goes, this is a hints at castaways. See, they'd say stuff like hints at castaways. So okay, another thing in here, we've got this ripped and torn fuselage metal. Aluminum skin was recovered, cracked and ripped with torn rivet holes, verifying extreme force, according to the National Transportation Safety Board review. Quote, this is a forcibly removed section of aluminum, which was once a part of airplane skin. Now, the thing about it is, and once again, you go to the evidential details process, and that is, if you have a problem with it, don't talk to me. Talk to the National Transportation Safety Board experts. Those are the guys that you want to challenge. So the bottom line is, you got 5/32 rivet holes, and you got 3/32 rivet holes. Those 3/32 are closer than the 5/32. What they did is that when they put that stuff up in the belly of the airplane, they put the rivets closer to make sure that it was actually the strongest part of the whole plane was the parts that had 3/32 inch rivet holes in the fuselage. Everything else was a little bit weaker at 5/32, but it's all that Lockheed really had to do. The bottom line, we got this aluminum skin, and it's got both rivet holes. What's that doing there? Not only do they go to those guys there at NTSB, but then they go in March 20, 2014, a report was issued from the Restoration Division staff at the United States Air Force Base National Museum at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. And they were able to, these are the guys that reconstruct airplanes. You know, they find an old Liberator bomber from World War II and it needs work, and they bring it into Wright-Patterson, and these guys work to reconstruct it. And so they know parts and fuselage skin. They were able to confirm that the part that they had was what they call 24ST all clad. That means aluminum clad, all clad. Earhart's Lockheed hat was skinned with that exact same all clad stuff. They said that the artifact was a piece forcibly separated from a larger panel of aluminum aircraft skin. At present, of the known losses in the Central South Pacific, only Earhart's Electra fits all of the requirements. Once again, I didn't say it. This is all just quoted by experts. So if someone wants to dispute this, they got to go to Wright-Patterson or get in touch with those guys, because they have to have a better idea. Most of the rivets failed in tension where the fluid force struck in a sheet on the interior surface with sufficient energy to blow the heads off the rivets. The sheet is perforated with four rows of rivet holes in this diameter and a precise pitch, which is interviewed between holes. I mean, it goes, I don't want to just continue to read all this stuff. One last thing here. Because the artifact was found on Nicomerero, it follows that the aircraft of origin was a type that was present at some time in that part of the world. Due to the remoteness of the Central South Pacific in 1937, those aircraft types are of a limited and known population. No one has really been able to overcome the NTSB and the Wright-Patterson reconstruction guys. And I don't know why you'd want to believe anything else. I mean, why believe something else when you can go into court, so to speak, and say, okay, Your Honor, here's Exhibit A, plexiglass. Here's Exhibit B, aircraft skin with different rivet holes, obviously showing a repair. See, and one of the strengths that we had, and what you find a lot with this Amelia Earhart mystery, is somebody gets an idea, and it's their own idea, and then they start to design facts to support their idea. And if there's something out there that doesn't support the idea, they discard it. Our strength was we didn't care. We didn't care what happened to her. We just want to know what did. If she dropped off into the ocean, that's fine. It's just where was it and how did it happen, this kind of stuff. As it turned out, she crashed at Nicomerero, and the plane disappeared in 3 minutes, and everybody started saying about how she vanished. There is one last thing I want to bring up here. There was a 10-strand electrical cord discovered at Nicomerero. The plugs at each end connected a 1930s Bendix electrical generator with a General Electric radio plug. Earhart's plane used both pieces of equipment. You have specialty plugs back then to plug in the Bendix with the GE parts. And when the thing crashed, that connection cable just popped out of the sockets. And it's in really, actually, pretty good shape. And what's that doing there? This is what happened, and this is the report that would have been sent to the Pentagon. Let's say there was a suitcase nuke on this plane and they had to find it. This is what would have gone, and this is where the Pentagon would have sent Naval Air, get this plane and recover it. And this is what this guy did for a living, and this is the report that I bought. And I mean, the Pentagon never targeted Amelia Earhart or anything, so.
Let me ask you this to kind of, you know, wrap up the interview. Let's ask you about the condition. I mean, obviously the plane, you know, you mentioned the plane kind of went over in a few minutes. Is it likely that the plane or remnants of the plane could be found now?
Oh, yeah. And McMonagle says it's in a debris field of 75 yards. Yeah, what it was, and here's one last thing with regards to these, the University of Hawaii going out there, they had this bathymetric, this big eye, kind of a bubble on the bottom of their ship for mapping, you know, sonic mapping of the ocean floor going down thousands of feet. So what was really kind of interesting about it is that they were out there, and there's nothing to do out there at Nicomerero. So the PhDs there, they said, hey, let's go out. We're never going to be here again. No one's going to pay us to come out here. So let's just go out and do the south side of the island. And they went out after like 6 p.m. and just went up and down, you know, kind of like a harvester or corn kind of a thing, just swaths up and down. And sure enough, the ridge that McMonagle said was going to be there at 650 feet showed up. It was unknown because this area had never, ever been analyzed before. There was the British soundings in the 1880s and nothing since. And then we've got a pure map of it. So I thought, oh, this is excellent. I mean, here's another thing that supports McMonagle and supports the idea that when he says it's in 650 feet of water, and there's the ridge, and it had like striations of color, like pink and then dark pink and then red and then yellow and blue, and the water was different color as it got deeper and deeper, and the color was right at 650, and it was like, wow, I mean, here it is. You know, if you want to go out and get this plane, I mean, it's right in the book on how to go get it, how to mark it. There's two steps. One is the discovery, so you mark it with this a big red-orange buoy. The other one is excavation, step two.
Okay, let's wrap up with one final question. It's the question that I always ask. Again, this is how I kind of end every episode of the show, too. It's a two-part question. One is kind of ties in the mystery, and I want to ask you why it's so important in your personal opinion, with all the work you've done in this case, why is it so important, do you think, for this sentence to have a period on the end of it? Why does it matter that this case gets solved?
It's like any mystery. There's all kinds of historical mysteries. And we just worked Jack the Ripper. And there's another one. I mean, you could ask the same question on that mystery. There's a lot of mysteries. Well, the whole series, the whole evidential detail series is working mysteries that are unsolvable. We've got a Civil War mystery and this kind of stuff. And in some cases, what I found is that the question comes up, should you let sleeping dogs lie? You know, you find, like in the Civil War thing, there was, you know, we were able to find out who lost this, what was called, you know, the Lost Order, who lost it, and the ancestry didn't like it. I never even thought about it. You know, we're just trying to solve this mystery because it was a critical mystery in the Civil War. Well, does it need to be solved? You know, I don't know that any mysteries, well, and the same thing with Kennedy, you know, who killed Kennedy mystery and these things. I think it's kind of like person by person, should the mystery get solved? Because people do like to know. People are curious about, I wonder what really did happen to Amelia Earhart, you know, that kind of stuff. And I don't know how to answer that, really. I mean, some people could say, I could care less. Other people say, man, I really want to know. And then there's every degree in between, person by person, and people change. They may not really be interested that much. And then they read a couple books. Next thing you know, it's a burning hot issue. They really want to know, you know, over a couple of years. And I don't really have a personal opinion about it. It's just, we decided we wanted to try and solve this mystery was because I always liked the Amelia Earhart mystery. And so I decided to try and solve it.
And the last question of the night is a little bit about impact and legacy. I mean, Chasing Your Heart, if it's anything, it's a legacy piece. Can you talk a little bit about your personal thoughts on Amelia's impact and legacy in 2019?
Amelia was a pioneer in aviation and kind of a woman's can-do spirit. She was out there, and aviation was considered really kind of dangerous back in the 30s. The aircraft was just not what it is today, and so she was a person that really got out there and took risks and gambles and did things that other women weren't willing to do or able to do. And as a result, and she's kind of like one of these, she's a heroine that's like ended up with a mystery about what happened to the heroine. So I think that this gets, it stokes people's imaginations. She's a number one aviation mystery in America, and she's the number one woman's mystery as to what happened to Amelia. And I think that that's her place as a kind of like a beacon or a guiding light for women who have the attitude as I can do this and I'm going to go out and I'm going to do it. And that's exactly what she did. And I think it rings true more and more as we go forward.
Scott, where can people find the book? Can you kind of plug the book? Where is it available?
You can go to evidentialdetails.com. That's one word, Evidential Details. It's also available on Amazon. It's the Evidential Details Mystery Series, and this volume is called Amelia Earhart Takeoff to Oblivion.
All right, Scott, this has been a pleasure tonight. Thank you for the enlightenment and talking about the book and talking about, you know, your work on the book. We will have links to everything that we spoke of tonight in the show notes. Scott, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart Podcast, part of our Castaway retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart Podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart Project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart Podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarrus Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Incorporated.
Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.